We begin the hour like we do every Tuesday by welcoming in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's going on, Kimball?
Well, just watching the weather out there. It's a great day. It's a Colin Fleming kind of day out there.
You sound nervous about this weather. Has some severe storm been forecasted?
Oh, no. It's school vacation week, and, you know, the little fella in my house would sure like to get out and do a little bit, although he was out kicking around a soccer ball in the mud today, so he's determined not to be cooped up inside by all of this.
I feel like the boy would be out there regardless. Sounds like maybe Mr. Kimball himself is doing a bit of heel dragging with the cold. Is that true?
Oh, no. I was out there early this morning getting my miles in, doing what I did. But, for all the youngsters who aren't as industrious as my progeny, I would like to see a little sunshine. It's that time of year. But either way, yeah, I'll be out there. The boy will be out there and the dog will be out there because we're Kimballs. Look, we're not Zulu warriors, as we've established, but we're somewhat hardy souls compared to the rest of humanity.
So there you go. Maynard, problem solved for everybody.
There you go. Perfect. Well, we're going to talk sports this afternoon in a whole lot of different areas. Should we begin with the Celtics since they've got a playoff game tonight?
Yeah, we should. Celtics, how are you feeling about them? I am, I don't know. I'm sort of feeling similarly about each of the two winter teams in town, although less confident with the Celtics. Watching that game the other day, and they sort of did what you expected them to do. They come out and they're blowing doors off, and then we don't have to try as hard. They stop pushing the pace. They stop running as much. Before you know it, it's 13, it's 12, and that just seems to be... I know it's a league where teams do, you always hear, you can't flip it on and off, but teams really do in the NBA. The Warriors are trying to do it right now, for instance, right? After not doing it all year.
Well, I was going to ask you about this. It seems to me that the NBA, much more so than any other league, is a league where teams consistently take a quarter off, hey, sometimes take a whole game off, but still find ways to win.
It's a decision to lose, I feel like, sometimes, all but lose. The whole sitting players thing, you have that in baseball for the most part, but how could you not with 162 games? It would be strange with hockey, same number of games, 82 is the NBA, if players just had these rest days. I guess it's different at the end of the year when you've clinched and everything and your playoff seeding is determined, but really, that's not how it works. It did this year for the Bruins, but even for the top teams in the league, there's still teams moving around near the end, matchups, that kind of thing. You want home ice for a game seven. The NBA is just it's a different mindset. It's a flip the switch mindset, and sometimes you can flip the switch. Whether you're an NBA player or an NBA team or whatever, I also feel like that's apt to catch up with you. And when you don't have urgency in what you do, it's not just urgency, it's the pattern of urgency. That the Bruins have that pattern of urgency. And I think when you have established that pattern, you establish good habits. And even when other things aren't going right and you're not right or you're not yourself overall as a team, it's still going to work out. So with the Celtics last year in the finals, I don't think really anyone thought the Celtics weren't the more physically talented team at this juncture or that juncture than the Warriors. So it's just, they're not going to lose to the Hawks, obviously, but you just, I don't know, you see that lack of a finisher kind of mode where you just want to put someone down and make sure they don't get up again.
Well, I wonder, too, with this new coach, Joe Mazzulla. Boy, he played, especially Jason Tatum, played a ton of minutes this season. And you wonder if there's not going to be some crash deep in the playoffs when they just run out of steam, which is why I think it's even more important that they finish off these early series as quickly as they can.
Don't you wonder about that, though? It seems strange to me because that was instead about, I just don't want to name like the best players from the past and like Jordan or Bird or whomever, but no one really thought about that or to switch sports. No one says that about Connor McDavid. He played all, I don't know if he did. He probably did all 82 games. And is that going to catch up with him? That like no one thought that caught up with Brian Trottier. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's a relatively new phenomena that is specific to the NBA. Well, to the NBA and to fragile pitchers in baseball with the inning counts. No, he's not going to go over 150 innings. And even if we are in the playoff hunt, we're going to shut him down. So how old is Jason Tatum? He's like 24?
Yeah, I think so.
Why wouldn't he? I just don't understand it. He's not a 36-year-old who is having his minutes managed because he's played. I mean, think of the wear on the tread of someone like LeBron James. Just how many minutes of his life have been spent on a basketball court? And sure, it's a physical sport, but it's not a physical sport like hockey is. And you never hear that about hockey players. I think it's much ado about nothing. You want to get series done quickly, but I don't think that's a wear and tear thing. I think that's an urgency thing. It's a focus thing. It's a commitment thing. And I still wonder if they've learned the lesson from last year, because I don't know. I with Tatum in particular, I just don't see that sort of assassin mentality. I feel like Brown has it a little bit more, but he's not quite the dynamic scorer that Tatum is. So I don't know. I feel like if everything's going right and everyone's doing their thing and Derek White's doing his thing and Al Horford's doing his thing and Rob Williams might be in some ways the key player for them, then if all goes accordingly, they should win it. But how often do things in sports or life go completely accordingly?
Well, and I wonder, too, I think there are times, and this series probably is a shining example, when they don't particularly respect their opponents and feel like, well, we don't have to give it our all to beat these guys.
Yeah, it's just strange because they haven't won anything yet.
Right.
And now they should have won, I feel like, last year. I'm sure they feel like they should have won last year. They should have been that number one seed this year. I guess maybe you can be confident and think, okay, well, if we have to go to Milwaukee for a game 7, we can see that through and do what we need to do. But I don't know. I know they won on the road last year against Miami in the game 7, but that game shouldn't have happened. They shouldn't have lost that game in Boston. And it's sort of sports Russian roulette. You're risking things and courting things that I just don't think you want to have a part of. I mean, you think about it. It's like when teams in all sports, don't you always wonder why they let up? Because you're only out there for a couple hours. I mean, is it like, okay, so is it sloth? Is it, it's going to make me tired later? It's going to make you the same amount of tired or not tired an hour after the game anyway.
I almost feel like sometimes it's boredom. They're almost thinking, well, let's let him back in the game. Let's get it close again and see if we can put him away a second time.
Maybe. I guess Larry Bird in the mid-80s would get bored for that game in the 85-86 season where he's like, I'm just going to use my left hand.
Right.
And then he was, and then they interview him after. He's like, I'm saving my right hand for the Lakers. That's a great line. But that team, that was, a 67-win team? They were toying with other teams. You're talking one of the, I mean, that Celtics team, you can make a legitimate argument that if it's not the best team of all time, it's the second best. I don't know, 95-96 Bulls, that 85-86 Celtics team. You can throw a Lakers team in there. You can't put in that Golden State team that won 73 and then gagged 3-1 lead to Cavaliers of all teams, but I they're not that good. I mean, they're a bunch of teams. The NBA is a little bit different now than the NBA used to be, because you there were only like one or two teams in the past that really had a shot. And now, how many teams are there? Five, six, seven, maybe? Certainly like a half dozen.
And that's why I'm not sold that they're going to win this whole thing, because I've just seen, as you have, too many times this year when they've faltered against a lesser team or let themselves get behind by 20 points and rally, but then come up short at the end.
Your sports window, too, is never as widely open as you think it is. Like, think of those Orlando Magic teams when it was Anthony Hardaway and Shaquille O'Neal. And it seemed like they were going to get horse grand. It seemed like they were going to be that team that was going to be dominant for a while. And nothing really happened. You can just be a nucleus when nothing really happened. I think Marcus Smart, I think his play is down this year. He's not the same defender he was the year before. It's been around for a while. Al Horford, he's not going to be around that much longer. Like I said, I think Rob Williams is the key. He seems to make them a different team when he's on both, especially in the defensive end, but even offensively, when he's confident in that aspect of his game. He always just seems to me like a guy who is on the verge of an injury, a reoccurring injury just coming back again, that's going to put him either out of the league or just really reduce his efficacy as a player. So, I mean, I don't know. It's hard. It's like I sort of look at these things like, would I take the team if I was a betting person and had any money, or would I bet the field? And I think it would be really difficult to bet the Celtics over the field.
I'm with you on that. Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's talk about the Bruins last night. A little bit worried going in with the bug that was apparently in the locker room, some key guys out, and then as this team has done all year, people step up. Last night, out of nowhere, Tyler Bertuzzi comes up big.
Yeah, he was definitely the best skater for the Bruins. He was. They needed him last night. And I'm not saying they needed him because Bergeron ended up not playing. I wasn't. It's one game, but I didn't really like what I saw last night. I thought that they were outplayed, especially early on. And if their goalie hadn't done what their goalie has done more often this season than people think, because I've noticed this narrative now that people think that there's just this fantastic lair-based defense in front of Ullmark, and that's why he has these gaudy stats for the Vezina. I remember watching a game against Calgary sometime this winter, I don't know, February, and it was, I think, the second night of a West Coast back-to-back at the end of a trip on the West Coast, Canada, all of that stuff. And the Flames needed that game, and they poured like 50 shots on Ullmark, and he single-handedly won that game for the Bruins. They had 15 shots against last night in the first period. Now, it leveled out over the game, but if he wasn't playing the way he was playing as the best goalie in the league right now, that's, you're looking at like 2-0. You're looking at 3-1, something like that. And you just, you don't know at that point. You don't want to be monkeying around with that. I thought they were flat, and they're so consistent, though. Even when they're flat and they don't sort of have that energy, they're so consistent in their habits and the way they play the game that can be enough, especially enough against a team that they're clearly better than. But again, I look at the time on the ice, and I'm the only person saying this. They do not think Charlie McAvoy is the player that everyone else says that Charlie McAvoy is. He is never the on-ice time leader for this team, or rarely. That doesn't tell you something. There's only a few seconds he was off last night, but he still wasn't. They don't think he's that 28-minute-a-game type of guy who should be out there more than anyone else on the team. They don't believe he's that player.
I don't think, with what you said, I don't think there's any way Florida can come back in this series. But I wonder about that next round. I look at a Toronto team as a potential obstacle to them going forward.
Well, look at that, the game last night. The first goal, the sort of behind-the-back Bertuzzi pass. Okay. That Marchand, like that wrist shot from whatever, above the top of the face-off circle, that was a goalie game last night. their goalie looked like a guy who'd never been there, and he let in soft goals. Your guy didn't. And the one goal he let in, it was a turnover where it was that sort of strange, the puck comes off the boards, the stick is angled the wrong way, it juts out into the center. I don't know why it was being talked about during the broadcast, like he sort of attempted to make a pass. It was more just the stick blade was angled the wrong way and out popped the puck, and it sort of looked like a pass. But that was a goalie game last night. With a competent goalie performance, you get a different outcome potentially last night. And it doesn't mean you lose the first game. I mean, to go back to basketball, the Bucks lost the first game. I mean, an injury had a lot to do with that. I don't think anyone thinks the Bucks are going to lose that series. And if the Bruins lost last night, I wouldn't think that they were going to lose this series either. But there was this op-ed I'd written, and I wasn't able to move it, but about the idea that in hockey now, it's a post-upset league. Upsets don't exist anymore. And at the same time, there isn't parity. There obviously isn't parity. You had a team that just had the best regular season in history. And if the Bruins hadn't had that sort of superlative season, the Devils and Carolina were right there. But they could beat the Bruins. The Rangers could beat the Bruins. Colorado could beat the Bruins. I feel like I'm the only person who doesn't really believe in Edmonton because I think they're too power play dependent. And if you look at when I look at the best players in the league, and this is going to sound bonkers, I look at, for offensive production, I look at even strength points. I'm more interested in that than your power play points. And, of course, McDavid is still amazing, but he's not dwarfing everyone when you look at even strength. If you're able to stay out of the box against Edmonton, you have to like your chances, I feel. So there are all of these teams, 4, 5, 6, whatever, that can beat the Bruins, and doesn't even require the proverbial hot goalie, and I wouldn't be surprised. At the same time, I expect them to do what they do and play the way they've played, because it's regimented. And I feel like when your success is based upon repeatable good habits, then you have a say. You have the choice. You've been doing this. It's ingrained in you. And I think they're going to continue to do that, and they'll be fine. But they were flat last night.
I thought of you last night. I saw this on social media, and someone mentioned who was doing the game on ESPN, and I switched over and listened to Sean McDonough on the call instead of Jack Edwards, and I enjoyed that game so much more.
I would have liked to listen to McDonough more, but this is how much of a New Englander I am. I listened to Jack Edwards, even though I wasn't going to like it as much, because I'm that. Well, you have to understand, so it's like I had gone to the movies yesterday at the Brattle. It's Marathon Monday here, and I went to see the Muppet movie, and I came back, and I was sitting in a cafe, and I was reading and doing work and all these things, and it's Hanover Street in the North End, so everyone has on their Bruins jerseys who are going over to the rink and everything, and it's so local and emblematic to me that even though Jack Edwards can be trying, let's call it trying, and Sean McDonough is, well, he reaped the benefits of nepotism, certainly, but he's good at his trade, and I also just don't like ESPN. I don't like anything ESPN. My experiences with ESPN with work were just awful. So, yeah, Jack Edwards and local flavor, but I don't know. I just thought it was sort of ho-hum and lackluster. And then I would have liked to have seen the Edmonton game. And I know that McDavid didn't score, but you have to be realistic about that hour, Kimball. That's not a Zulu-friendly hour.
All right, on to the Red Sox. So I had completely dismissed them last week. I was calling for heads to roll, not just Bloom, but Alex Cora, the whole bunch of them. And then they rallied and had a pretty good weekend against a mediocre Angels team. But to me, this Red Sox team, they're not just bad. They're worse because they're uninteresting.
I agree. And so, I mean, I have all of these stats just in my head. But in case I was overlooking anything, I went on Baseball Reference and I went through every Red Sox team of my lifetime. And there was always something I liked about them. Now, there's a lot of bias in my likes. I, for instance, like the player Tom Bernanski. Now, I know that in and of himself, Tom Brunansky might not be the most scintillating draw for a team. But in the 80s, when it was hard to hit home runs, I mean, sort of, Tom Brunansky and Dwight Evans were part of that stat of guys who hit 20 home runs 7 years in a row or more. And it was only like four guys about whom that was true. So I just sort of dug him. And he had a cool, like, Don Ross Diamond Stars card. So I was into that. And they had Clemens, and they had Boggs, and they had Yastrzemski before that. And then even when they were in the 90s and sort of uninteresting in a way, competitively, you had Mo Vaughn, the hit dog, Nomar Garciaparra, and Pedro Martinez, who was always interesting. And even those very frustrating teams between the playoff run of 98 and 99 and then back in 03, when you had that sort of those down years with that massive payroll in the middle, you still had Martinez, you still had Manny Ramirez. You had the frustration of like fielding an all-star team that was going nowhere, and you could sort of like anger watch. Now it's like, I don't know, who am I supposed to get? Like, am I really supposed to care about Verdugo? Because when he comes up, I think, well, at least something might happen here. He's one of the better ones, but I don't care. I don't know. I mean, it just isn't that interesting to me.
No, and what can you get excited about? The subtle stylings of Tristan Casas as he takes a walk and celebrates that he went 14 pitches without taking a called third strike? Now, those are the little things that drive me crazy. And I know we've talked about this before. They are so fundamentally bad, whether it's base running, defense, throwing to the wrong base, not hitting the cutoff man, situational hitting, pitchers who never check runners. It's little league stuff.
Who was the guy I wrote about on the blog? I said it was just one of the, maybe the worst play I've ever seen from the Red Sox, where was, and they were down in Tampa, and they had gone behind, they came back, they were down by two runs, they get the first runner on the top of the ninth. Red Sox guy, nobody out. Red Sox guy, obviously not a hitting pitcher. He shows bunt. I'm thinking, what are you doing? Like, is this some like ploy, like a fake out to get the third baseman to come in? So you're going to Nelly Fox it past him, right? Like, I'm like, wow, so headsy. Or is this stupid? And Korov, like, you're sitting there, you're not saying, hey, getting the third base coach's attention, different sign, something. And then he sacrifices in a two-run deficit with nobody out, the guy to second base. I mean, really, if that was Little League or T-ball or something, that's when the coach/dad takes the kid aside and just says, oh, hey, just keep this in mind. That's not what we want to do. We don't want to give out the out. That run doesn't really mean anything. How does that happen at the major league level when there was like a chance to rectify it because the threat of this happening had been shown on the pitch before? That's as inept. I couldn't believe that. And then they've obviously told the announcers, hey, kind of cool it. Don't be like so bad. And finally, O'Brien, he asked, it was Euclid at the time, did you like the bunt? And then pause. No. And you could just tell he was thinking what I was thinking. Anyone would be thinking it.
Despite all of that, and I do think they're bad, but there's so much mediocrity in the league, I can also still see them hanging around just enough to be in consideration for one of those wild card spots come August before they eventually go belly up.
I don't know. I feel like what they just pulled off, what are they, 8-9 now? I feel like they had to exert themselves with what quality they had to get to 8-9. I think like 500 is their ceiling. You can't, I mean, it seems like the wild card, even though everyone gets in now, you still have to win 90 games. And so I look at this pitching, their best hitter so far, injured. Of course, that was going to go that way. Chris Sale, as much as I despise him, he can't be that bad with his body type, his delivery, the angle he's coming from, the movement on his slider, with the velocity that he still does have. But once he figures out command a bit more, he's going to get hurt. So that's going to offset that. Whitlock, I mean, that seven innings the other day, off the top of my head, and I haven't, like, paying it, like, religious kind of attention, they might just have two quality starts 2.5 weeks in. The Pivetta, the loss, the 1-0, right, to Tampa, and then that Whitlock. I can't think of another one.
I don't think they have. I mean, Hauk had a couple of good outings, but he didn't get to six innings.
Yeah, right. The six innings, it was like Mount Everest. I mean, now all it's just driving to the parking lot and looking up at the thing and then going back home again. I don't understand. I just, if you were a stud pitcher right now and you were coming up, wouldn't this just suck? Because isn't your dream to be that guy with the ball and you're out there the entire time? But then it's like, you can go five if you're efficient. We don't want you going through a third time. We don't think you or anyone at all, Walter Johnson, is good enough for that, let alone you. So you're kind of like this stretch relief pitcher who just happens to go first.
You're right.
Like a hitter, you can still, growing up with the dream, I want to hit 40 home runs and walk off home runs and all that kind of stuff. If you're a pitcher now, it's just so anticlimactic. I just wouldn't be into it.
I want to do my five innings and then be in the clubhouse with my feet up as the game ends. That's just not the same.
No, it's just defeatist before you start. The whole, you can't go through the lineup three times. It's just so boring because it used to be the coolest position in sports. It was the most theatrical, like grand theater, the pitcher. The man in the middle of everyone else that we're all looking at, each time he came out for his start, it was a potential Homeric quest. How was he going to fare? He was going to be the story one way or the other, if he left after an inning and two-thirds, or if he went 8 2/3 and finally had to scuttle off for someone else to finish what he had started. But it was his journey. Now it's like his bus stop. It's like, oh, I took it off. It's like Charlie in the MBTA, but instead of like riding perpetually, it's like, oh, it's time. I'm out. And he goes home.
I'll get off here. I want to talk about a little bit of great sports writing before we wrap it up for today. And one of the great books ever written, I think, about sports, I think published back in the 50s. I first saw it in the 80s when it came out in paperback form, A Day in the Bleachers, and it reminds me so much of what you do with a lot of your writing, particularly in music, focusing on one song and turning that into an incredible story. And that's what Arnold Hanno did, looking back at Game 1 of the 54 World Series.
Yeah, you're exactly right, I'd say, that he was this fan, a thinking person's fan, and he went to support his team, the Giants, against the Cleveland Indians. And no, that's not me saying something wrong. They were the Indians. And led by Larry Doby, who actually was tutored in outfield prowess by Tris Speaker, kind of dispelling a racial myth right there. But this is the series, and this is the game of the famous Willie Mays over-the-shoulder basket catch. And it's a book that is quite depressing in some ways when you contrast how this guy, obviously a smart guy, but going to a game, how he saw the game versus how people see the games, any games, if you go on something like Twitter. Because what every single person on Twitter sees in the game is just not what I see at all. Like, I don't agree with any of it. It's like we're watching completely different things. Or sports talking heads, when they weigh in, I never agree with them. I never think that they're close to right. I find it depressing because I don't think people know anything about anything. And I don't even just mean like history or facts or anything of that nature. I don't think people know how to perceive something as close to what it is anymore. So this is a book about a day in the baseball life of a fan in the bleachers and the fellow bleacher creatures and all the different personalities. And it is, I'd rather have read the book than be able to actually go to that game, because you're sort of getting to go to the game anyway. It puts you there.
Yeah, and the fact that because of his perspective out in the bleachers, he didn't think it was a great catch by Mays. It was sort of, from his perspective, a standard Mays catch. And when he saw him at full speed heading after the ball, he was pretty confident Mays was going to catch it. But if you're watching it from, well, on TV for those who had it in the day, or from the broadcast booth, it looked a lot more incredible.
You have to wonder how often that has happened with certain plays where the lore has replaced. I'm not saying this is the case, but lore has a knack for replacing reality.
Mm.
Talked about that Mickey Mantle, that home run, was it 563 feet? Like, if you do the physics, is it even possible to hit a baseball that far? I mean, the barometer would have to have a certain reading or something like all of these different things. Even the Ted Williams, was it 502 feet that went through the guy's hat?
Right.
That's quite a poke. I don't know if we're going to see a 502-foot home run this year. And these guys they're big guys. I remember one used to think of Jim Rice as a big guy. If you watch old video of like the 86 Red Sox, Jim Rice is this like wiry little dude. He's not what we think of as a big guy, Vlad Guerrero sort of guy now. So the Mays, I wonder what actually he was more impressed with was Mays' throwing.
Yes.
In his display, batting practice, fielding practice before the game, that he was just rifling the ball to the different bases, and it was either getting there on a hop or on the fly, and from not even taking kind of a crow step, just boom, into the mitt, gun sort of thing. So the catch was, it was almost like what he expected from Mays. And Mays, that was kind of his thing too, the basket catch.
Right.
Did that a lot. When I read about this as a kid, it made it sound like there was the only time he'd done this and he had to do it. He would just sometimes catch a fly that way because he could. That was just a sort of go-to for him.
Another great piece of writing from Ken Dryden, one of the great goalies of all time, one of the most interesting pro athletes, at least in my growing up period following sports. The idea that this guy was also a lawyer just blew me away. And his wonderful book on the 78-79 season, The Game, one of the great sports books of all time and maybe the best ever about hockey.
One thing about Dryden was he was in the perfect situation for someone with his intellect to be on that team in that time, in that he could kind of go his own way. He wasn't around for that long, right? He only played, what, eight? Because he had that year off when he was becoming a lawyer. Was it eight full seasons? And this is kind of something that people don't say, and maybe I'll get in trouble for it a little bit, but it is very difficult to be a highly intelligent person on a sports team, especially a hockey team, because if you listen to the interviews that guys give, and they're not even referring to their teammates by their last name, but it's like, hey, Timbalo was giving me the puck over here. Like, and they're just doing the nicknames and everything with the Nesson reporter. There's that kind of boys club buy-in that's necessary and not a lot of thinking or noticing even or critical thinking or you all have nicknames for each other. It's kind of juvenile. I mean, it just is. That's not something that I'm making up. I might be like telling a tale out of school type of thing. Dryden was not that guy, but that was a very regal franchise, I would say. And they had regal players, and it just was a sort of different time. Guy Lafleur and Serge Savard, they weren't sort of doing the nickname and boys club kind of juvenilia. And so Dryden was there. He was there for a while. And the book has a weariness that he was coming to an end of, I can't do this anymore. There's more to life than stopping vulcanized rubber. And he writes, though, at times, like he's sports Proust. When he expatiates on Guy Lafleur and the nature of his talent and how it's meant to burn for a short period of time and not possess a great deal of sustain. That's exactly what, and this is when LaFleur was the best player in the world. And that's exactly true about LaFleur, because in just a few years, he's really not close to that guy anymore. He's like a 70-point scorer after that point.
Ken Dryden's The Game. If you haven't read it, get a copy of that. Read A Day in the Bleachers. And, of course, follow Colin out there on Facebook. Go to the website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog if you want great writing on a daily basis there. Colin, thank you, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.